is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, January 17, 2025. I'm your host, Brianne Doyle. Rabble.ca shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labour, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on Rabble Radio, we're sharing a clip from our first Off the Hill political panel of 2025. In this panel, our guests, including NDP MP Nikki Ashton, senior researcher at the CCPA National Office, Stuart True, economist Jim Stanford, activist and writer Judy Haven, and Rabble's parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg, talked about Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's resignation announcement, his accomplishments and failings during his time as leader, Parliament's current prorogation, and what's next for Canada. Here is a small clip from that panel. Take a listen.
So, Nikki, Donald Trump's victory was partly due to a huge backlash against wokeism, which Pierre Poilievre is clearly capitalizing on based on what he said in his recent interview with Jordan Peterson. So considering many of the issues the right has labeled woke, like racial and gender equality, are key NDP values, how will your party deal with this in the election?
Well, I think this question could take up the entire webinar. So I'll try and give a few thoughts on this. And first, you know, I will say I'm not sure that it's entirely accurate to say that that's why Donald Trump won. I think we have a lot of lessons as progressives in Canada to take from what the Democrats did wrong and the opportunities that they missed leading into the previous election and prior to that. But what's clear, you know, to me is that we have our work cut out for us here. You know, I want to spend a moment, and I do appreciate the question does touch on the Poilievre interview that we saw recently, an interview that I would classify as frankly terrifying. I mean, creepy, way out there, but a very clear indication of exactly what his agenda is going to be. And it is one that no holds barred seeks to roll back the clock on women's rights, on LGBTQ rights, and particularly trans rights. I would say in terms of the rights of working people, rights that the labor movement has fought for decades. You know, I would add to that Indigenous rights, the rights of racialized communities, newcomers here in our country. And what's clear to me is that Poilievre is not holding back, and he's telling us exactly, you know, how he plans to run the show. And I would say, first and foremost, the takeaway is we can't let him do that. I think it's clear that we need to fight like hell against the Poilievre agenda. An agenda that is reactionary, regressive, and will only seek to make Canada more unequal. Despite all of his slogans around the system being broken and this sort of cosplays as being a champion for working people. You know, I think it is critical. I mean, I think the NDP is the only party that is well placed to say, wait a second. I mean, we are not going to let Canada be hijacked by Pierre Poilievre. We stand to lose far too much with him as prime minister and a conservative party under his leadership in government. And we need to be steadfast in standing up, of course, for our principles in support of equality, gender equality, racial equality, and Indigenous justice, standing up for working people. But we also need to be clear that this is about class. And Poilievre, much like the Republicans or some Republicans have done, they're banking on dividing us and them. But it's not the us and them that we know is the problem on the left. The fact that most of us are pitted up against the rich and powerful who are exploiting working people at a rate that we've never seen, inequality the likes we've never seen in our country. We need to be clear that that our vision is one that looks to lift everybody up in the face of rampant inequality, and be very clear that Poilievre is the one that is going to exacerbate that inequality. Right, this guy was a key architect in the Harper government that pushed Canada in a direction where we became more unequal, where they cut corporate taxes, where they expanded tax loopholes, where they allowed oil and gas, first of all, provided massive subsidies and allowed them to get off without paying anywhere near the kind of taxes they deserve. They're the ones that shifted the tax code away from values of gender equality. And they're also the ones that, of course, we know carried on the Liberal cuts to social programs that also contribute to the inequality that we face. And so we need to be clear as New Democrats, as progressives, that we are here to stop the clock from being rolled back on our fundamental rights, but that we're also very clear that the vision going forward for Canada is one in which we are taking on that inequality, where we are making it very clear that it's time to tax the rich in a way we haven't seen before. It's time to go after the rich and powerful that both conservatives and liberals have done nothing but favors for. And so I would say that, while there are lessons to be learned from the U.S., let's focus on the work we have cut out for us politically. Poilievre is not hiding who he is. We know his track record, despite the slogans he's using. And this is the time as progressives to come together, fight back, and put forward a bold, class-focused vision for the kind of Canada we all deserve.
Stuart, you published an article in November titled "Trump's Tariff Threat is About Borders, Not Trade." What do you mean by that? And how, if at all, does Trudeau's resignation impact what you said?
I guess I wrote that fairly quickly, Robin. At the time, we needed to say something. I mean, Trump had just come out with this pretty wild, inflammatory, I wouldn't even call it an announcement, right? Remember, it was something he posted about that long on Truth Social. About how he was going to just attack Mexico and Canada on day one, right, with 25% tariffs on everything for some pretty vague reasons, right, related to the border, maybe, related to immigration, maybe something to do with defense spending. And it had the desired effect, right? I mean, if as we know, Trump, it whipped up a hornet's nest of debate in Canada and panic. And so the point I think I was trying to make was it did come out of the blue in a sense, because Canada had been preparing us and I think preparing probably behind the scenes for quite some time to deal with some kind of Trump effect or Trump decision on tariffs, right, on trade, should he get elected. But it was always based on this idea that there would be some kind of economic rationale behind it. And here he was just kind of coming out with straight up coercion, right? This was a threat. This was borderline violation of international law, right? To kind of force some kind of decision on Mexico and Canada that they might not want to take. Maybe we want to take it. Who knows? We don't even know what he wants us to do at the border, right? As an aside, I saw we've hired two helicopters, I think, to send to the border. That was a big announcement today. We don't even have the helicopters. We've leased them from some private company. Anyway, I don't know if that's going to appease Trump. But the point is, this was economic coercion. And that we'll have to wait and see what Trump really wants once he comes into effect. But it doesn't set a good tone, right? Right off the bat. Since then, though, and the reason I'm not completely committed to what I was saying in that piece is because since then he has been raising economic trade-based reasons for imposing tariffs, not just on Canada, but obviously on the whole world. We're expecting something. I don't know if it's going to be day one, but it does look increasingly, based on news reports, that there will be some kind of tariff plan coming out of the Trump administration. It might be phased in. It might be 1-2% a month. It might be 25% on all countries, right? We don't know. It's obviously something we're going to have to scramble to deal with, right, when it comes down. And so, yeah, does Trudeau stepping down, that's the other part of your question, have any impact on this? I don't think so. Trump was really hounding Trudeau before Trudeau decided to step down a couple weeks ago. I don't think his stepping down makes us in any better or worse situation. Again, we don't know what he wants, right? And we don't know exactly what we're going to have to agree to get rid of those tariffs if they do come into place. And it frees up Trudeau to some extent, right? As we saw today, there was a meeting with the premiers, and it looks like they have a plan that most of them can be happy with, right? With the exception of Daniel Smith in Alberta, who doesn't want to do anything to upset the U.S.-based oil companies, right? And having the oil continue to flow. So, you know, I don't feel terrible, right, at this point. I think we should be extremely worried about the impact of a 25% tariff if it comes to that. But I don't feel terrible having this kind of level of political uncertainty with respect to the next leader of the Liberal Party.
Jim, let's bring you in. The Center for Future Work, at which you are director, released a new report earlier this week showing that Trump's complaints about Canada-U.S. trade are not backed by facts, and that Canada, in fact, subsidizes the U.S. and not the other way around. Will Canadian negotiators be able to convince the U.S. of any of that, and how will it play out in the Canadian election?
What a surprise that Donald Trump doesn't let the facts get in the way of his bluster.
Shocking.
I do think, I mean, you know, we in a way we get immune to this just because we hear it from him all the time and we just kind of laugh sometimes, but we do have to challenge it. You know, he was out there the other day saying, A, the trade deficit they have with Canada is $200 billion, and B, that constitutes a subsidy. We're a charity case. The U.S. is bailing us out through this trade deficit, and the number is completely made up. There is no evidence anywhere, no report, no statistical source where you can say the U.S. has a $200 billion trade deficit with Canada. Their own official numbers from the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Economic Analysis said it was $40 billion, so that's one-fifth the size, in 2023, and then it declined another roughly 10% this year. The final numbers won't be in for a few weeks. So the number is all wrong, but the theory is even worse, right? The idea that because they have a trade deficit with us means they're subsidizing us is nonsense. What it means is that we sell a little bit more goods and services in America than they sell in Canada, but the two-way flow is enormous. First of all, it's $1 trillion a year. So 40 billion might sound like a big number, but it's peanuts in the grand scheme of the bilateral trade. In fact, America's trade with Canada is more balanced than almost any other of its major trading partners. And the size of the deficit with Canada is the 10th largest. It's like a sixth the size of their deficit with China, a quarter the size of their deficit with Mexico, and so on and so forth. And then the other thing to remember is the U.S. has run a trade deficit every freaking year for the last 49 years, since 1976. 75 was the last year they had a trade surplus. So this isn't new. It's not an emergency. It hasn't even gotten worse. It's actually shrunk a bit as a share of U.S. GDP in recent years. So the whole argument is nonsense, which suggests, you know, he's just throwing this out there. As my old president at the CAW used to say, Buzz Hargrove, he's throwing shit at the wall and seeing what sticks, and just trying to mess up the opponent, keep us disorganized and frightened and intimidated. And, you know, to some extent, it works. You know, you've got corporate Canada obviously running around trying to make hay out of this moment to advance their own agenda for things. You've got Daniel Smith, you know, breaking ranks with the other provinces. And you've got conservatives saying, Trump's got a point. We should do what he says. And he doesn't have a point. So, I admire Stewart's calmness just now when he said he's not upset, he's in a good place. I think Trump is going to go ahead with something dramatic. I think that's, you know, how he rolls. Canada is obviously not the only place in his crosshairs. He's playing, you know, brute force power economic politics with all countries in the world. Remember, he said he's going to impose a tariff on everyone, not just Canada and Mexico, but also China and the rest of the world. So this is, I think, a serious crisis for Canadian economic development and sovereignty. You know, we oriented, rightly or wrongly, we all think wrongly, our whole economy around exports to the U.S. after the free trade agreements. And it's hard to unscramble an egg. That's where we produce and sell stuff. So we should be under no illusions that a big disruption in that is absolutely going to cause a major recession here. And then I'm more worried about the political fallout, you know, the fracturing that would happen from a recession, given the ugliness of Canadian political discourse these days. So I want some of Stuart's calm pills. Okay, send me some.
Carl, let's bring you in here. There's been lots of talk about how bad Trudeau is from all the people who don't like him. But in a Rabble article you published last week after Trudeau resigned, you cited some of the good things his government accomplished. What were some of those things that you cited, and why did you feel it important to mention them?
I should say a lot of the list is because these are policies that the NDP pushed on the Liberals, either as part of the confidence and supply agreement, or simply that the NDP had for a long time advocated these policies and then the Liberals adopted them on their own. But nonetheless, to list the accomplishments of the government in the area of economic and economic slash social and environmental, a carbon tax. Yes, this is what they're getting killed for politically, but actually coming into power and saying that there has to be some way of trying to deal with climate change, at the same time as the government also, by contrast to the Harper government that preceded it, signed on to international agreements such as that in Paris on climate change and tried to work constructively. There's lots of flaws in the government's climate change policy and in Canada's climate change performance, but it is good intentions. And Canadians listening to this broadcast or looking around should note in their bank accounts, many of them, that they got money back. They got the carbon tax rebate. It's somehow the government has been bad at the marketing of this policy, because I think a lot of us come ahead in the carbon tax game, because if we add up the rebates, it's more than it's very difficult to calculate, you know, how much are you paying for a carbon tax, since it's not just gasoline at the pump or heating oil or products such as that, but it's an input into other things that we purchase. So it's very difficult to make a clear calculation. In any case, there you go. The carbon tax is one. Very early in their tenure, Justin Trudeau's government made a break from the previous Liberal government. I call it the Krejci and Martin government. It was always a partnership of the two, in that they were looking at ways of spending money and redistributing money and dealing with shortfall of funds to fund what they wanted to do. And rather than merely looking at cuts, which was the Krejcian attitude all along, when they faced deficit, what they considered to be deficit problems, they only had one solution: cut, cut, cut. Paul Martin said, we're not raising anybody's taxes by 1 cent, no matter how rich they are. You cannot be too rich for us. You can be earning $1 billion a minute, and we're not going to ask you to pay 1 cent more to slash a deficit. We're just going to slash healthcare and transfers to social services and make people poorer and make people and make it more difficult to get health treatment and other services. This government raised taxes a little bit, but some on people, the rate on people earning over $200,000 a year. They did it in a funny way, and they redistributed it in a funny way, but that's a different issue. It showed a certain amount of breaking with what had become a pattern going way, way back to the Mulroney time, that we would not ever raise anybody's tax or any kind of tax, except, of course, the GST, a consumption tax that hits the poor as well as the rich, hits the poor more. So that's another thing in their favor. The Canada Child Benefit, which really has resulted in a significant decrease in child poverty, has brought hundreds of thousands of children out of poverty. And then the $10 a day agreements for childcare, again, now that was strictly from the NDP. They just borrowed, that was an NDP policy prior to the 2015 election. The Liberals said they didn't go for it. They weren't in favor of it. But to their credit, they changed their mind and adopted it afterwards. And then, you know, the more recently, we have the beginnings of universal pharmacare or something, targeted pharma. We don't have the same kind of utterly universal program we do with healthcare, Medicare, as we call it now. We have targeted dental care and pharmacare, but they are going ahead with it. And then I'd say they also, listening to the NDP, they raised the federal minimum wage, as well as passing an anti-scab legislation. Again, something the Liberals in the past have been opposed to. Guess who voted for it as well? Pierre Poilievre. Every single member of parliament voted for that. And then on the Democratic front, they succeeded. Finally, you know, during Harper's time, the Senate was a cesspool of scandal, and they succeeded finally in making some kind of reform. At least now we have a Senate where we have people like Kim Pate and Francis Lankin are members of the Senate, because it's based on some kind of merit system, and the senators appointed aren't as representing a political party. They're independent senators. So Trudeau was only appointed independent senators, nonpartisan senators, based on a whole process for selecting them at arm's length. The Senate is not a perfect institution. The NDP would like to abolish it, but that is a constitutional amendment. Achieving a constitutional amendment is easier than entering heaven through the eye of a needle. So, you know, we're not going to do that in Canada. You know, their language on refugees and immigrants, they promised 25,000 Syrian refugees when they were going to come into office, and they actually did it, and they sort of changed the whole tone and language. The Conservative government, Harper, used to use refugees as punching bags, used to try to get political hay out of it, used to try to scare people about being flooded with all kinds of dangerous people, and they stopped that. Of course, the one piece, I won't mention this quickly, but the one piece of Democratic reform, which to their eternal shame and his eternal shame, Trudeau not only failed to do, but has been, since he's failed to do it, he's been gaslighting us with lies and made up arguments and excuses since then, is electoral reform. And that is their greatest failure as a government.
Thank you for that. This is a great segue to bring in Judy. As Judy, you published a blog post last week called Fallout from Trudeau's Resignation, and in which you describe yourself as, quote, way to the left of the Liberals and also to the left of the NDP. And then you went even further than Carl in terms of listing some of the good stuff that Trudeau had accomplished. Carl just went through a pretty big list, but was there anything in there that he didn't mention that you'd mentioned? And again, why did you feel the need to mention some of those good things? And kind of related to that, you know, what advice would you have to folks in the next election who feel they're more left than the NDP? So that's kind of a combined question, but over to you.
Thanks, and thanks for the invitation to come tonight. Well, I just wanted to thank Carl, actually, because our blogs or our postings got crossed, because he mentioned 10 very good things, well, generally speaking, good things that the Trudeau government's done. And of course, they were pushed in a lot of this to by the NDP, which is very good, which is the way minority government is supposed to work, actually, in this country, at least in civics class. They tell you this is a good idea. And I also mentioned, but I mentioned about five other things that I just briefly touch on right now that Carl didn't mention. But altogether, this brings me to 15 or 16 things that the Trudeau government's accomplished that have been actually good things. Now, of course, there have been bad things too. But when we're looking at social policy or something like that, you know, I look at the fact that there is this dental care for the elderly, the disabled. It's either free or it's cheap. How much longer we're going to have it if this government falls? I don't know. We have free contraceptives. That's a big deal, actually, in this country. And free drugs for diabetics. It's a very big deal when we see that, you know, 5 to 7% of the adult population, I think 10 even percent, are diabetics right now. Daycare, making it more affordable. I think Carl talked about that. And of course, the National School Food Program is a huge deal here in Atlantic Canada, where, well, here in Nova Scotia, we have the highest incidence of child poverty, I think, in the country.
NDP MP Nikki Ashton, senior researcher at the CCPA National Office, Stuart True, economist Jim Stanford, activist and writer Judy Haven, and Rabble's parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg in our January 15th panel, Off the Hill Election Year in Canada. To watch the full panel, check out Rabble TV or Rabble's YouTube channel. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. Here to bring us up to date is Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting with world news. On Wednesday, January 15th, a ceasefire agreement was reached between Israel and Hamas, pausing the violence in Gaza. Since the start of the conflict in October of 2023, over 45,000 Palestinian civilians have been killed by Israel, mostly women and children, and 60% of all structures in Gaza have been destroyed. In 2024, the UN said that Israel's campaign in Gaza shared the characteristics of a genocide. It is because of this violence that nonprofit and other activist groups continue to advocate for justice and accountability. In a statement published in response to the news of the ceasefire, Independent Jewish Voices Canada said, quote, "The perpetrators of this genocide must be held accountable and Palestine must be free," end quote. In labor news, education support workers at two school boards in Alberta are fighting for better wages. The workers are represented by the Alberta branch of the Canadian Union of Public Employees, or CUPE. According to CUPE Alberta, the average yearly salary for education support workers in the province is only $34,500 a year. These low wages are creating issues for recruitment. In Edmonton Public Schools, one of the boards where education support workers are on strike, that school board is seeing a 10% vacancy rate for education support workers. In response to the strike, the school boards have brought in substitute teachers to do the work of the striking workers, a move that CUPE Alberta condemns. And finally, in national news, political science experts feel that Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's prorogation of Parliament will likely stand up to any legal challenges. Trudeau announced last week that he would be resigning as Prime Minister and proroguing Parliament until March 24th. As Parliament is prorogued, no legislative business is being done, no bills are being debated or passed, and no parliamentary committees are meeting. There are some groups, such as the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms and Charter Advocates Canada, that are considering or have mounted legal challenges to the prorogation. Experts such as Matthew Hennigar, Associate Professor and Department Chair of Political Science at Brock University, says, however, that Trudeau's decision to prorogue Parliament is on solid legal ground. There are few restrictions on a Prime Minister who chooses to prorogue Parliament, especially if they've recently won confidence votes in the House of Commons, which Trudeau has. As always, you can read the full version of all the stories we talked about today on Rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. Thanks as always for tuning in. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please rate, review, share Rabble Radio with your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble Radio. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
You're listening